my second chance to introduce an introducer, although I know so much about her I shouldn't say anything. It's our redoubtable editor, Carol Pearman. She took over the helm of River Styx magazine this past year. She put out three of the finest issues that I've ever seen, and she's steering us to the point where we can put out three regular issues of the magazine. That will hopefully happen next year. And we're also hoping she can help us a little bit with starting a small press. But more from her. Carol?
This is the 20th anniversary of the Summer of Love, an anniversary celebrated last week in New York City by poets Allen Ginsberg and the aforementioned Ed Sanders of The Bottom Line. River Styx hasn't been around quite 20 years yet, but it's working on it, and it's nothing short of a miracle that the organization has lasted as long as it has. For literary organizations have the life expectancy of a June bug. Two of the most distinguished American magazines bit the dust this summer, the Greenfield Review and Open Places, and those were very successful magazines. The fact that River Styx has published 24 issues over a span of 12 years is a real tribute to the faith and grit of Michael Castro and Jan Garden Castro, my predecessors. And the index is a veritable honor roll of American authors and artists. Let me read to you a short list of some of the writers and artists published this year alone. Grace Paley, Al Young, W.S. Merwin, Edward Corin, Sharon Olds, Derek Walcott, Marilyn Hacker, Victor Hernandez Cruz, St. Louis writers and artists, Raymond Leslie Williams, Lauren Cuoco, Robert Pettis, Sandra Huss, Constance Erdang, John Rosell, soon to be St. Louis and Mario Vargas Llosa, Marjorie Stelmach, Howard Nemirov, and Mona Van Dyne. I could go on and on, but let me just say that the magazine is always on sale here at Duff's during the nights of readings, $5 an issue, $14 for three, and $17 for all four of the most recent issues, including Family Album, Prose, and Photographs by William Gass. I'm going to close with that and go on to introducing the next reader, Marjorie Stelmach, one of the people who's in River Styx number 22. A couple of years ago, a friend of mine went to a reading at Washington University. It was a reading given by students in the graduate writers program. And my friend came back from that reading raving about one of the poets, a young woman who read a poem named Life Saving, which she described to me in such detail that it was almost as if opening a gift this fall. When I opened an envelope and there was Life Saving available for us to publish in River Styx number 22. Marjorie Stelmach has had poems in other magazines this year, including Ascent and Malahat Review. And this is a momentous day for Marjorie Stelmach. She just heard that she has won the Billy Murray Denny Poetry Award, an award that carries with it a stipend of $1,000. Please welcome Marjorie Stelmach.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Like Jane Wayne, I'm going to say as little as possible in between poems, and then maybe I'll get through this. I'd like to begin with a poem about birds, and you must understand I have no right to read a poem about birds, because I am the daughter of a birder who has been trying for a long time to teach me the difference between a mockingbird and a robin. I will nevertheless read a poem about birds. The title is from Emily Dickinson, who said in one of her letters that she was one of the birds that stay. The birds that stay. Brown, gray-brown and small, we settle low on your lilac bushes, hesitant on your fences. And there we grow certain of a few things only, that summer will bring berries to the pyracantha, that winter will thicken our feathers and our bones will fill with warmth that seeps through window glass, that spring will find us eventually bringing young to be taught our small brown songs, the ways of wings, and the rhythms of thunder and lawn sprinklers, that each season will bring us 1 year closer to that distance we are assured of traveling, whether we wait here patiently or pace the tugging skies, letting our blood flow for miles along ancient north-south arteries, as if there were no end to our importance and the forces we must answer to. Our answer is no. We are the birds that stay to attest to the rightness of this place and the old laws that abide and are nothing like duty or fidelity, but will come to that for you who must grow toward your own autumns without wings or the clarity of seasons, and enter into winter when it is as still and white as things ever get. And even then, it will be hard for you to see that there is nothing in the distance and there is no choice. The second poem is about a youngster who wakes up at night calling for daddy. She's had a nightmare. The poem, however, is from daddy's point of view, and it's called Her Father's Nightmare. When she wakes straight up screaming, he is already there, his weight on her bed, his gravity against her. Father and daughter, eyes narrowed to the glare of midnight. Something huge, she says, and he has no answer. He sees his face distorted, stretched across her eyes, while in the world behind, something huge draws back. And yes, it was just a dream, and yes, she's fine, and yes, yes, he can go. No, she is not fine. Back in his own dark, he knows this time she won't call, knows he's lost her. From his own dreams, he'll watch her. She'll sink toward her own center, no one's daughter, while the beast gathers in all the corners. I made myself a promise at one point never to write a poem based on a tarot card. The title of the one I'm going to read next is The Hanged Man's Dilemma. But there's a saving grace in this. I also made myself a promise that I would find a way to use the word comeuppance in a poem. It's in here. Listen for it. The Hanged Man's Dilemma. Being first has drawbacks. Say you're snagged at the ankle, snatched into air to hang smack in the center of everything. If you're smart, you keep quiet about it, careful to alert no birds or gods. If you must make signs, you stick to clubfoot gestures. Risk nothing. Look natural. After a while, it's a lot to ask of a man in your position. The blood does rush to the head, and it's hard to find anything in this bleak landscape to account for your predicament. The dangers you survived look paltry when you look back. Nothing special. Didn't your final comeuppance lie looped on the ground, looking natural? And now look. I know I was a real pain to my parents when we traveled to Michigan every summer, with my brothers and sisters fighting over who got to sit by the window and how much of the back seat belonged to whom. I have no children of my own, but my friends with children tell me that their children are also a pain in traveling. This next poem is about the joys of traveling with children. But it's about perhaps a little more than that, the pain of being adult and having yet a childish heart to deal with. Traveling northward. The hours I've gripped this wheel up at dawn, dragging into one more town at last light, haunted by voices, Chicago, St. Paul, from high on the FM dial. Newscasts, weather, phone-in want ads, the malice of rock, the bitterness of country. All the while talking to my heart, explaining things. My voice spreads like a Twinkie in the sun, plump with spoiled syrup, till cramped in the back seat, my heart grows hungry and begins to whine. But I push on, past good food, past home cooking, past all-you-can-eat fish, patiently handing back cookies, taking no notice of crumbs or the thirst I know is growing. Sighing dramatically, shifting positions, my heart complains of boredom. As we enter the tollway, she kicks her heels absently into the upholstery. I wonder aloud why we don't get on together, vow to try harder. My heart says nothing exactly, but I hear it. Later, she relents, asks how much farther, asks, are we there yet? And so I take it up again, that old argument. In the mirror, she curls her head away, curls her lip, but I go on talking to the wires beside me, to birds perched there, to candidates smiling from signs at city limits, to children on billboards, their mouths filled with chicken legs, their eyes wide as bullet holes. Repeating signs I remember passing, you are entering the land of 10,000 lakes, the lost pines of Estevant, the little Firestall River. Making up names, Stony Farm, Old Man's Error. Above the trees, a shadowy flintwing. Here, 100 northern blur flies, and off in the distance, a field of blue nails. Talking at last to neon or the moon, whispering words that will pass across their own consonants with the least disturbance, blanket and pillow, telephone and coffee table, delicate, difficult, disappointed. At dusk, a litany of old excuses, earth, truth, death, flesh. At dark, a simple modulation, earth, truth, death, presence, a kind of fatigue, a kind of fidelity. Behind me in a dream, my heart stirs and breathes deep but doesn't wake. I tell myself it's best. I say, someday I'll leave her home. Trying to interest her in this world has made me old. Sometimes there's an epigraph you stumble across that's so good you live with it for years, hoping that you will be able to write a poem to attach to it. Barry Lopez wrote a wonderful book called Winter Count, among many other wonderful books. In passing, he dropped this into my life. This is the epigraph. There is a rite of imitation in which a band of people from one tribe, Arikara, for example, would imitate a band from some other tribe for long periods of time, 15 years or more. They began doing this on the northern plains in the 1820s, imitating each other in exacting detail as a form of amusement, playing the long joke. See what I mean? I had to imagine what that would be like. The poem is entitled Playing the Long Joke. And I promised my father that I would tell him the $1,000 poem, so Dad, this is the $1,000 poem. One morning it begins, all of us at once becoming you. We cast off our accustomed robes and dress in your manner, wrap our skins tighter on our shoulders, make small tucks in our sleeves. We confine ourselves to dove and russet tones, shunning the lovely cerulean dyes brought down from the hills where we send our sons to hear the laughter of our gods and come home men. One morning we wake restless, and it begins. The elders teach us what they know of your ways. As our children sleep, we whisper your histories into their ears. We shake seed rattles above our babies' faces, sifting your rhythms into their dreams until your heroes rise from the dust to instruct them in the arts of dance and language. It is not enough. We train our furtive sons to steal into your camps and send back word. We sacrifice our daughters to your marriage beds in trade for knowledge of your privacy, instinctive gestures, the postures of your solitude. From them, we learn to touch the tips of our fingers to our foreheads in grief, to lift our phrases modestly when speaking of love. In time, your fears haunt us, and we understand what your silences lead to. In the early years, we help each other, adjust a pleat, correct the angle of an elbow, add salt. But soon, we have only to watch each other to know how things are done among you. And only rarely do we glimpse our former selves disappearing into the eyes of our elders. As we fall ill with your native discontents, we invent your medicines. We stare off into black skies until we see the shape stars take among you. On the longest nights, we modify your myths in keeping with your faulty memories. In troubled years, we chant the sacred words that alter the details of your destiny. When we begin to smell like you, our spies come home, though they never know for sure if they have arrived, and we give them no help, submitting them to subtle tortures of your design, admonishing our young to learn the dismissive smile with which you honor death. In the final years, we breed your priests, misfits, fools in loose blue robes who visit the forbidden hills and come home mad. And soon, we'll bear your savior, a hero born to laugh and slap his thighs and call us home where you live now, or have always lived, lying in wait. Some of us will go. When you kill us, we will die, your deaths, down to the last detail, smiling as our blood runs out, giving us away to the slow-witted gods. I have one more very short one. I suspect it may also be about the long joke of living. It's called What to Expect. We know what we have the right to expect. Long waits on the welcome mats, blank looks from bank and fortune tellers. We've seen how it is with the world, long faces in church, long gaps between letters, and longing, longing. But love. We expect love. It doesn't seem reasonable not to these days when so little suffices. And so we move through the tears of strangers alert for the lifted lashes of those we somehow expect to be kissed by. Ah, yes, we have expectations. But then we expect them to fail, for so the sad histories tell us. And more it seems doubtful that wishes are horses. Beggars were born, and we'll die with our cups in our hands. It's right that we die. We expect it. But gods, we expect gods.